argument now in the case of United States against Foose.
May it please the court.
Mr. Coffey.
Mr. Coffey.
Yes. We wait till everyone has a chance to get seated.
I thought he was. I'm sorry, Judge.
Mr. Coffey.
I represent Alvin Faust, who was indicted in a superseding indictment in the Eastern District of Wisconsin. There were originally three counts, one related to a conspiracy to distribute cocaine, both powder and crack, one related to the use of a firearm in furtherance of a drug offense, and the third was a money laundering. We had a trial before Judge Clavert. Much of the brief submitted to this court really is premised upon an assertion that there is insufficient evidence to support jury verdicts with respect to the two counts my client was found guilty of. I understand and recognize this court's standard and that it is difficult and a high bar and all of the other descriptions used by this court to describe what it is I'm attempting to do. However, I think that this case is a bit unique in light of the third complaint we have, which relates to the conduct of what happened after the jury began deliberations. Included within our brief and appendix is a note that was forwarded to the district judge. Our complaint about a supplemental instruction the judge gave.
Mr. Coffey, can you point to specific language in the judge's supplemental instruction that you think was coercive or otherwise violated Silvern?
Well, I think that my response is not so much language included as that which was excluded. As the government acknowledges in its brief, there is not in the supplemental instruction a direction to the jury that they should reconsider their positions but not give up truly held beliefs. There is not language in the instruction related to the burden of proof always remaining upon the government. So that in terms of the supplemental instruction, it's not so much what was added, it's that which is absent, and I would also suggest it is, just in terms of the instruction, that would be my response.
Go back for a moment to your sufficiency argument. In your brief, talking about the possession of a firearm count, you say that the possession of the firearm must be exclusive. Is there any case law to substantiate the fact that the possession of the firearm must be exclusive, that it can't be shared with a confederate?
I believe that it's don't hold me to the pronunciation, Machey, capital M-A-C-H-E-Y, which is cited, which talks about exclusive possession of the firearm may be the test, and then if you go to Castillo, which is also cited, it talks about if you don't have that exclusive possession, then there are these other considerations that one might go to. There are cases, obviously, where law enforcement enters a premises, they find drugs and guns in precisely the same location. Castillo specifically talks about, well, you can present expert testimony about the relationship between weapons and the drug business. None of those things are present in this particular case. Having been asked that question, I'll stick with the gun issue at the moment. This is a situation where on August 18th, my client and two of his friends were standing on a porch next to his father's garage. He is not in the premises. He is put into the premises by law enforcement. They conduct a search. They find weapons. They do not find ammunition that matches with any of the weapons. So he is not even there but for law enforcement putting him there. And the indictment in this case says he possessed the weapon in furtherance on August 18th. I submit there is no evidence that that is true on August 18th as to the garage. There is then another search conducted on 21st Street. There are a lot of weapons found. There are small quantities, if you will, of controlled substance throughout the house. There is no evidence of my client having been in that house at any point. That is to say, there is evidence he resided there, but no indication as to when he was last there. There is no evidence of controlled substances being stored in that house, but for these little quantities we found. And specifically, there is evidence that when quantities were brought to that location, they were, in some instances, according to the testimony, tested, but they were immediately removed from that, from those premises. The government takes the position that the stop of my client approximately 2 years before August 18th, driving an automobile while armed, a violation of state law, but no drugs, no suggestion of involvement in drugs on that occasion. It was a driving violation he was stopped for. So there is no evidence in the record from any of the cooperating witnesses that they ever saw my client carrying a gun, transporting a gun, or having anything to do with a weapon in relationship to those items that were in the 21st Street home. So I would submit that there is not evidence, number one, of possession on August 18th, on or about, and there is no evidence that he was using or had those weapons in furtherance of some drug activity.
Well, how should we then get past the government's arguments that there were so many other Duran factors, including the accessibility of the guns, their location near where the drugs were processed, near the bedrooms for protection, the sheer numbers of weapons, although, of course, that's not a Duran factor that was distributed throughout the house and business, you know, sort of as opposed to being in a case the way a gun collector might have them, that you know, sort of common sense dictates when so many guns are found distributed all over a house used for sales, drug sales and activity, and drug processing, that they're being used in furtherance of drug activity.
Well, the difficulty with that proposition from the government's point of view, as far as I'm concerned, they don't have drug sales. They don't have drug activity other than, I believe there's testimony on one occasion, there was testing done at that house and the substance was immediately removed. So they don't have many of the things you have just suggested. Clearly, there now is some suggestion everybody's entitled to have weapons, and I assume over the course of the next few years we're going to have all kinds of exceptions to that right. And I understand that in Wisconsin you can't go carrying a concealed weapon. But the fact is, in a residence, how the guns are kept or where they're kept is not a violation of federal law unless and until there's this nexus shown. And there's not a nexus shown. In this particular instance, there is no evidence other than those weapons being in the house that they had any relationship to drug activity. And in particular, there is no relationship to drug activity on August 18th or days just before or just after, because nobody testified he was there. There are others who live in the house, and they have no evidence in the record. He was the owner. There's no fingerprint evidence. There's nothing other than the presence of the weapons.
You know, in the brief, you asserted that there was no sharing of profits. Do you also disagree with the government's statement that Heredia and Faust were pooling their money, selling to mutual customers, jointly deciding to whom they would sell, how much cut they would add to the drugs, and what they would charge for the drugs?
I disagree with the suggestion that I will not disagree that some of those activities occurred. I disagree with the suggestion that that is exemplary of a conspiracy. It's a situation wherein Mr. Heredia, because of his relatively frequent vacations from the business, he's in and he's out, he's in and he's out, there is no common practice going on. The one time frame, I guess, that I would point to is his last arrest. He basically turns the business over to his father. His father is then involved with another individual, Mario Garcia. The evidence suggests, and the government argued, that Faust actually had turned it all over to Garcia, which isn't the fact. And the rest of the evidence in the case establishes that wasn't the fact. So did they have a common supplier? Yes. Would my client on occasion have cooked for Heredia? Yes. But in a commercial venture, not because he and Heredia were combined in the use of the product. Each of them had their own customers, their own prices. So my position is, and obviously I've argued, it falls within the notion of the buyer-seller situation. It is a situation wherein, having tried the case, I can honestly say I believe in all the time I've practiced law, it's the first time the government has ever been the initiator of a remark to the court about let's declare a mistrial. And then I get the government's brief, and while that's mentioned, it obviously is a situation where the government wins, so the government's happy. But the fact is that after 17 hours of deliberation, the government said to the judge, they've been here long enough, we ought to call this off. And obviously, I seconded, as did my co-counsel. Judge Claver disregarded our positions, which obviously as judge he's entitled to do. But the problem I have with what ultimately went on with the verdict in this case is after 17 hours they send a note wherein the foreperson says, we will never, ever reach a majority. Now, I assume he meant unanimity, but maybe not. The note says majority. We will never get there. We have tried, we have tried, we have tried. I've asked people to reconsider. And the judge's response to that was to give this supplemental instruction. And without inquiry, I mean, it's a situation where the foreperson offered to give the judge an update on the numbers, where people stood. And none of that happens. There are no inquiries. The jury goes back, and very shortly later, not only do they come back with verdicts, but they find both of the defendants not guilty of one count, find my client guilty of the gun count, but interestingly, on the conspiracy count, they come back in the special verdict form with the lowest number possible. And it's a situation wherein I think that, as suggested, we've cited Arizona versus Washington. At some point, I submit it gets to the point where a defendant's right to a unanimous jury is being affected and impacted. And I would submit in this case, they end up with a compromise. And it's for that reason I started my remarks with the facts of this case mean something. I have reserved some rebuttal time.
You have about 30 seconds.
Oh, thank you.
Mr. Jean-Pietro.
Excuse me.
Yes, Judge.
But do you think we could just get one administrative matter out of the way?
Yes, Judge.
Because on page 20 of your brief, you discuss the relationship between Heredia and Faust during the summer of 2004, and you discuss how they would pool the resources and work together on drug sales. After argument today, do you think you could provide us with a citation to the record for those assertions? That is for the middle paragraph on page 20. I, for one, would be very grateful for that.
Yes, Your Honor, of course we'll do that. I believe in the statement of facts there are some cites to the record with respect to that, but I will confirm that and submit something after the hearing.
Yeah.
But I recognize there's no citation in that argument section, but I believe it's addressed earlier in the brief.
I may have missed it.
But we'll certainly look into
but
it.
But I'd be surprised.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Gordon Giampietro. I'm an assistant United States attorney in Milwaukee, and I represent the United States. There are a number of issues here. I hope they're covered adequately in the brief, but I do want to address the two issues that I think the panel has already raised this morning. One is the Silverman instruction, the issue of the deadlocked jury that Your Honor raised. I think this case, of course, there's no dispute that the instruction given differs from pattern instruction 7.06. The question is, does it matter? And I think under Hammond and Rodriguez and Willis, this instruction that Judge Clifford gave both before the jury retired and then as a supplemental instruction does not deviate in any material fashion from 7.06. It is not coercive of unanimity, which is really the touchstone, I think, from Rodriguez. To the extent that it lacks certain language, this case is consistent with Rodriguez, that the lacking of that the absence of that language, again, does not coerce the jury into reaching unanimity. The second issue raised here by the panel, I think specifically, was the 924C count. In terms of the evidence at the 21 Street residence, in the brief at pages 8 and 9, you'll see copious citations to the record that established that really was the hub of the drug trafficking activity. With respect to linking this defendant to those firearms, there were some significant firearms recovered in what is agreed to as his bedroom at that residence. There was, among other things, the type of firearms that you would not necessarily associate with lawful activity.
Now, why shouldn't we be concerned that so many people other than the defendant had access to those firearms?
I don't think that there's a requirement of exclusivity in terms of the possession element of the offense. And I think we do have some evidence linking him to this bedroom. And I think what you have is you have a loaded, at least one loaded handgun on the mat under the mattress, a loaded shotgun against the wall next to the bed, a MAC-10 in the closet with a bulletproof vest, and a flash suppressor. And this is, Your Honor indicated under the test in Duran, this is the kind of common sense, these are the kinds of facts that would lead a jury to, using their common sense, to associate these firearms with drug trafficking. So, again, with respect to the characteristics of that residence, his association with that residence, the record at pages 8 and 9 of our brief, I think, established those facts.
I'd like to get your take on the last issue that was raised by the defendant with respect to the relationship of these two counts. As I understand it, he says, look, the count two really talks about the use of a weapon with respect to conspiracy in count one. He gets a lot of extra time for having that weapon around. Really was unfair for the judge then to consider the presence of that weapon in sentencing on count one.
I don't know if that is a fair I realize that's one phrase in the judge's sentencing analysis. He mentions that. He mentions the quantity of drugs. I don't really think in context he was saying that I'm going to give you consecutive time simply because you possessed a firearm. I don't think that's a fair reading of his entire analysis. I think he saw this as a fairly significant extensive drug trafficking activity. The nature of the firearms that were recovered, this was a classic drug trafficking activity. I think also it's not stated by the judge, so I don't know how much you're going to allow me to defend the sentence based on this, but there's certainly evidence in there with respect to putting the names of cooperating witnesses on the Internet, you know, rats, whosarat.com.
You seem to say that I'm not going to doubt go out be below the guideline range on one because there's a weapon involved.
I don't know, Judge, if that's a fair reading of his comment. I think he's saying that there's sufficient evidence in this record, including the gun, that satisfies me that a sentence at the bottom of the range is appropriate. I mean, I recognize the sentence is there. I have to wrestle with it. But I don't think in context it's fair to say.
If that's what he did say, would he have been wrong?
I don't think so, because under the guidelines, that guideline range specifically did not give him the two-level bump for possessing the firearm under count one, because it was encompassed as part of count two. So I don't think so, Judge. I don't think it changed.
It's just a matter of whether he wanted to go any lower.
I think that's fair. I think that's fair. I think I've addressed, hopefully I've addressed the Silverman question, the 924C question. If there are other arguments raised in the briefs that the court would like clarification on, I'm happy to address them. Otherwise, I'll rest on the brief. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Coffey?
Yeah, I have my 30 seconds.
Of course.
Two items. The first is, when the government says there's an acknowledgement of a bedroom being Mr. Faust's, there is no acknowledgement by the defense. They found some documents, and if that's the reference, I can't quarrel with that. The second is with respect to the sentence that was raised. The point is he didn't get a two-point bump in the guidelines, but he was and that's only because the judge was obligated to give consecutive time. It wasn't a discretionary choice. So he, in fact, included the gun as a consideration in his sentence on count one, and there is then the mandatory penalty imposed with respect to count two. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.